So I'm just talking about ignorance or avidya and how it is conditioned by other factors, and in particular I'm talking about the five hindrances and how these essentially either weaken or strengthen avidya depending on the strength of the five hindrances themselves. And it's quite simple to understand why that must be the case. And just consider yourself when you are in the grip of some kind of defilement, right? You are upset with somebody or you're angry about something. And very often when we act on that anger, when we act on that upset, we often regret it afterwards, right? When the mind is clear again afterwards, we think, oh, that was silly, that was a mistake, I shouldn't have done that. And so the clarity of the mind is always, that's when you know, that's kind of the baseline, and you can think back and you know what was appropriate and what wasn't appropriate. And from that you can see that when the mind is defiled, you tend to have mistaken judgments about what you should be doing. And that mistaken judgment is like avidya, right? The more powerful those defilements are, the more powerful is your lack of understanding, the more powerful is the delusion of the mind as a consequence. So a very close relationship there. And as those defilements die down, the clarity starts to arise. And one of the things that I always advise people to do in any kind of life in general, whatever it is always if you're going to make a decision about something, because you know that the defilements are going to distort your outlook, it's going to lead to delusion, make decisions in life whenever you feel relaxed, whenever you feel at ease, whenever you feel your mind is clear. Don't make decisions in the middle of turmoil, when you feel confused, when you feel in the grip of some kind of defilement, anger or desire, whatever it is, because you're going to make stupid decisions in those cases. If you want to make wise decisions, wait till you feel at ease. It's easy to say, right? But often emotions, they often compel us to act. Emotion says, you must act now, right? The desire is strong, you've got to act now. That's what the emotions say. But actually, instead of allowing that compelling force of emotions to make us act, we should hold back and say, wait. Wait till you feel at ease, then you can make good decisions about things. Especially big decisions in life, right? But even small ones, actually, how we treat the people around us, it's important to have that balance of mind. Only then can you make a good decision, really. Yeah. So this is a very important thing, and of course, once we understand that the five hindrances are the cause of delusion, they make our ignorance worse, and we understand that the path of Buddhism really is a path for getting rid of those five hindrances. And that's why the Buddhist path is often called the Suddhimagga. You may have surely heard about the Suddhimagga, the famous book in the Theravada Buddhism written in about the 5th century by a very famous monk called Buddhaghosa. And that book is called the Suddhimagga. It's a very nice title, actually. But of course, the real Suddhimagga is not that book, right? That book is just nicely titled. The real Suddhimagga is the path of practice you find in the suttas. You find in the early Buddhist texts, that's the real Suddhimagga. So, you know, the fourth noble truth, the noble eightfold path, that's the real Suddhimagga, the path of purity. So now you can start to see how these things fit together, right? The jigsaw puzzle kind of comes into place. Dependent arising and dependent arising, the way to undo that whole sequence is by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path or any other aspect of the Buddhist path. Leads to purity of mind, delusion dies down, and eventually we can see things according to reality. So says the Buddha. So that is the causes or the conditions or the nutriment for ignorance or for delusion itself. And now what I would like to do is to move on and have a look at the second factor of dependent arising and see how that links in with avidya. And this, I find this quite fascinating to understand how these things work. But before I look at the actual connection, let's just very quickly look at the word itself. The second factor of dependent arising is called sankhara in the Pali language. And this word sankhara is used in many different contexts in the sutta, so it's important to understand specifically what it means in the context of dependent arising. It's one of those words that everybody's struggling, how do we translate sankhara, right, this way, that way, and that's why, you know, even a brilliant translator, like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who has translated most of the discourses that I printed out here. Even he, sometimes he has to kind of use terminology which is very hard to understand. Like here, volitional formations, right? And to me, it doesn't really mean very much. It doesn't really mean that I'm criticizing Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. It more means that the difficulties of being a good translator are actually very difficult and sometimes very hard. But in that case, I think I would have chosen to translate this differently. So what does it mean? And the basic meaning of sankhara, the way that Pali words are constructed, they're all constructed with prefixes and suffixes. Sankhara is sang plus kara. Kara basically means to do, to act, from the verb karoti, which means to do and to act. So it means any kind of action, right? Whatever that is. And sang, it means like almost like together. So one way of translating sankhara, it means like putting together, acting together, putting together. Right? Putting together means like to create. Right? It's a kind of act of creation, act of doing something. Whenever you create something in your life, you are sankhara, right? So, if this is sankhara, right? I'm creating something. Whatever it is, even if it's something very humble, right? You're writing an email to somebody or an SMS or something like that. That's a sankhara. You're creating something. It is driven by the mind and then it comes out. So it is basically the creating activity of the mind. That's what sankhara is. So whenever we create something, that's a sankhara. And creation is ubiquitous. It happens all the time. It's everything we do is really an act of creation. Every time you think something, right? It's a sankhara, because you are creating that thought. It's interesting. People think, oh, I sit and meditate and all these thoughts come in my mind, right? Why do I get all these thoughts? I don't want to think, but still, they're coming into my mind. And that's what it feels like. It feels like you are the victim of this thinking, which is kind of coming in like some alien which is invading your personal space. But the reality is that thinking only can arise if we want to think it. Deep down, it is a creation of yourself, the fact that you're thinking about things, fantasizing, thinking about the future, thinking about the past. It's actually driven by ourselves. It's very hard to see. It takes a lot of mindfulness, a lot of clarity to be able to see the intention behind the thinking mind. So pretty much everything that we do is a sankhara, because everything is driven by the will inside of us. If we want to do this, the doing is what lies behind this. So sankhara in this second factor of dependent arising is equivalent to what is called chetana in the Pali. Chetana means basically the will. So often use the word volition. Sometimes people wonder what the word volition means. But the word volition is just like the will, right? It's the will, the thing inside of us, which makes you do things. When I lift my hand, right? It's the will lifting my hand. There's something inside of me which causes me to do that. That's the will. When I drink this nice cup of tea, it's the will that does that. That was a nice excuse for having a sip of tea. It was really, really good. Sometimes I had to find the loopholes. So all of this, so everything we do, all the drive inside of us, everything which gives us direction, the will, the doing, all of that is sankhara. Now sankhara means also other things, and that's why it gets so complicated, and that's why you get complicated translations like volitional formations, because sankhara can also mean things that have been created by the will, right? All the, this weird kind of thing in the Pali language, the activity which creates, has the same word that those things that actually are created. Not necessarily by the will, but that have been formed, come into existence somehow. All the things in the world basically have been put together somehow, they are created. Not only these things have an essence in their own right. So because of that, they're also called sankhara. So this is what complicates things. And it also has other meanings as well, but I think we'll leave it at that. In dependent arising, it is equivalent to the will inside of us, the creative force, right? Now, so what happens then? What is the connection here between avijja and this creative force inside of us? Now, first of all, the creative force, of course, is very much dependent on craving, on tanha. We do things in a very large part because of the desire inside of us. The tanha has a very important role in sankhara formation. Whenever you desire something, whenever you crave something, every something you will do, it is the will that carries out the purpose of the desire that actually is sitting at the back there. So from desire comes then the will, right? The tanha is very important there. Desire is very important. And the less desire you have, the less you are usually likely to do that. So what is the connection then? And the connection is that, as I was saying before, there are these two basic aspects of delusion that are very important to understand. And the two basic aspects is the lack of understanding of where real happiness lies. Lack of understanding of what is suffering, right? That inability to see this clearly. And then the feeling that we actually are the doers inside of us. These are the two issues. And because of that, because we feel, we think we know what our happiness lies, and we think that we are in charge, so we're able to do that, of course that gives rise to the will, right? The will then comes into play and starts trying to carry that out, because we feel that we can do this. So avijja, quite naturally, leads over into volitional activities, by mind, by body, by speech, by whatever. One thing feeds in to the next one. So this is how that whole thing comes to be, right? So one thing leading to the next one. So depending on our level of avijja, depending on how deluded we are, we will do different sankharas. So if you are very deluded, right, and you think that happiness is to be found in being really bad, right, being violent, being, you know, a terrorist or whatever, if you think that's going to lead to happiness, that's what they do, right? If somebody is a terrorist, if somebody, you know, wherever that might be, they actually think that there's something positive in that, otherwise they wouldn't do it. They don't do it to cause suffering for themselves. They have some kind of deluded idea that this somehow will cause good for themselves and perhaps also for others in the long run. That's kind of the idea they have. It's very deluded. That's the idea behind that. That's a very coarse form of delusion. Then a kind of a lesser form of delusion might be to think that, oh yeah, happiness is to be found in the sensory world, right? So I should go out there and I should amass as many objects and things in the world, as many kind of nice relationships and all these other kind of things. I should, you know, build up a kind of a status for myself or whatever, all of these kind of things. And by doing that, again, it is based on delusion, because as I was saying before, these are all borrowed goods. We forget about that, and then we forget about the big picture, and we focus on the small picture, and then, you know, we cause suffering, perhaps later on, because we haven't looked at the long run of things. So that is a slightly lesser form of delusion. And then as the hindrances start to die down, right, you find yourself becoming more peaceful. And the less there are of the five hindrances, the more you enjoy meditation practice. Right? So you can see the will changes, right? The will, your inclination of your mind changes. The more peaceful you are, and the more you know that that is where happiness is to be found, the more your mind will incline towards that. The will, the volition, will move towards meditation practice, will move towards peaceful states of mind, because now you know that that is where happiness is to be found. And as the defilements die down even more, the more your mind will incline towards just sitting still and peacefully, until the day comes, what I was saying yesterday, you just have to sign back and meditating, right? That's all you want to do, really, because you understand that that is actually where real happiness, or at least, maybe not real happiness, but semi-real happiness, right? The beginning of happiness is to have at that particular point. So your inclination of the mind changes, your volitional activities change, depending on the level of ignorance. And these things tend to be quite stable, right? Most people in the world, they're born in the human realms, they do human things. Doing human things means precisely finding happiness in this world. So your volition tends to be stable, it tends to go for those things. Unless there is a shock to the system, in which case you kind of can be drawn aside, either in a positive way or a negative way. You know, a shock to the system might be something bad happens in your life, and you become very disillusioned. So you decide to join ISIS because you're disillusioned with the world. another shock to the system is one day you have this beautiful meditation, right? You think, wow, now I have found it. This is not a shock, it's a positive shock. Nevertheless, it's a shock to the system. And your whole attitude changes as a consequence. But if you don't have those shocks to the system, you tend to stick basically where you are. You are in the human realm, that's where your volitions are, and you try to find happiness in that particular area. I like this idea that, you know, we talk about trauma very often, and trauma, you have a very difficult experience in life, and it kind of sits in your psyche, you can't really get rid of it, right? It causes nightmare problems for a long time into the future, because you've been through something very difficult, like maybe the war in Syria or something like that. But there's also the positive trauma, and this is what we're trying to experience in meditation practice. When you have a really deep, profound meditation, it's like a positive trauma. You can't get it out of your mind, right? Your mind is always wants to go back there. And of course, that's a very powerful thing, this idea of positive trauma. It's the idea that once you have that experience, it means you're always inclining again towards that, because it's become such a powerful thing in your mind. So this is how this whole thing works. What is interesting about this, one of the very important points about this, is that, remember, you think, you feel somewhere deep inside of you that you are the doer, right? You feel as if you are in charge of this. You feel that you are the doer. And because you feel that you are the doer, you feel responsible for your actions. You have no choice but to feel responsible. Now this is... This, of course, again, this is to different degrees, but in the end, there's always some degree of responsibility because you feel that you are the doer. What that means is that when your volitional activities are based on defilements, when you're doing something which is not nice to other people, you have no choice but to take some degree of responsibility for that. Because you have no choice but to take some degree of responsibility, you are dragging yourself down. You feel bad afterwards. You feel a sense of remorse. It is absolutely natural. You have no choice but to feel some degree of remorse. It may not be like, oh yeah, I feel really bad about it. It may just be a slight darkening of the mind. It's like graying of the mind. The mind doesn't feel so bright anymore. You're reducing your sense of joy. That may be all it is. But in a sense, you have no choice but to take ownership of that action. And then, of course, you can also use that for your advantage. If you know that you have no choice but to take ownership, it means that if you do a good act in life, again, you feel responsible, right? And because you feel responsible, you feel, wow, great, right? I did something nice. So now you are, in a sense, using the delusion of the self to your own advantage. Every time you do something good, you must take responsibility. You must take ownership. So it means you do something good, it lifts you up. You feel lighter, you feel brighter, you feel that the burdens of life are being cut off. It's like a balloon soaring, right? You feel your mind soaring, you get perspective, you feel this lightness inside of yourself, and you don't have a choice about the matter. So what this means is that every time you do an act which is not so pure, which isn't kind, which is perhaps even unkind sometimes, everybody does unkind acts every now and again, it's just life, and it's okay, you certainly shouldn't judge yourself unnecessarily for that, but every time you do that, you are dragging yourself down. It will affect you psychologically. You have absolutely no choice about the matter, because you think you are the doer. Even if you're not, you think so. And every time you do something good, it lifts you up. So when you start to see that, you think, whoa, I've got to stop doing those bad things, right? I really have to purify myself. All I'm doing is dragging myself down. I'm making my life miserable by doing bad things. And if you are careful, if you watch yourself and you watch your mind as you go through the daily life, if you have enough mindfulness and you have enough clear comprehension in your mind, you can actually see this happening in real time. And I would recommend you to try to see this. What you are seeing is karma in action. Remember, the idea of karma is very broad. Karma, of course, is very often used to define how we do in this life, how it affects what happens in future lives. But karma is also about this very life right here and now, right? So you can, because it is about this life here and now, you can actually feel it here and now, how karma operates. So watch your mind. What happens if you do something which is unkind to somebody here? What effect does it have on you psychologically here? And you can feel that if you do something which quite literally is unkind, you say something which isn't nice or whatever, if instead of focusing on the object, you feel yourself instead, you can feel there's a drop in energy there, there's a drop in brightness, there's a drop in happiness. You can feel that you're bringing yourself down, quite literally. Experience that, because when you start, if you're able to experience that, it becomes a bit scary, right? You're kind of dragging yourself down into this unpleasant world. It becomes scary. But also look at the exact opposite. When you do something that is really kind towards somebody else, how does that feel inside of you? You give somebody, you just do some very kind, little kind act, right? Like offering me a cup of tea, for example. Another excuse for having a sip of tea here. So, what happens when you do something kind? You feel energized. You can feel it straight away. Energy comes to the mind. The mindfulness becomes clearer because energy and mindfulness are two aspects of the same, two sides of the same coin. You feel all the sense of joy. All of these things coming right in the present moment. So be aware of that. What you're seeing is karma in action. How karma unfolds in this very life. And it's very powerful when you see that. It becomes very powerful. It becomes a very strong motivating force for living a better life, for being more kind, and for avoiding the unwholesome actions. Because in the end, you realize if you are unkind to somebody else, if you are unfortunate, they will be a little bit hurt, right? If you are fortunate, they won't be hurt at all because they will just ignore you. But the person you're really hurting more than anybody else, you're hurting yourself. Do you really want to hurt yourself? Even if you succeed in hurting the other person, if you're hurting yourself much more, isn't that complete madness? It is complete madness, right, when you think about it. You don't really want to hurt yourself. You want to make yourself feel better. You think that by hurting the other somehow it's going to affect you well. But actually, it does the opposite instead. It drags you down. So be aware of this. And what starts to happen here when you do that, if you're able to avoid the bad things and just do the good things, is that the volitions, all the mind, kind of leans that direction all the time, right? It leans towards goodness, it leans towards doing what is right, and it leans towards higher states of mind. And as you're lifting up your mind, it's like your mind is shifting it. You're shifting your whole personality, your character is changing, you're becoming a different person. Your consciousness is being lifted up. Just like on a good day, when you feel really good about yourself, you feel your mind is higher. On a bad day, you feel your mind is lower down. It's exactly the same thing, but you're doing it on a more permanent basis. And this leads on to the third factor, which is how sankharas condition vijnana. The vijnana, the level of your mind, vijnana is consciousness, the level of your mind is directly affected by your sankharas, what you do. It must be, because you're taking ownership. Because you're taking ownership, consciousness has to be affected. Your entire mind will be affected by your volitional activities. You can see how all this thing feeds through, right? You have less ignorance, because you have less ignorance, you start to understand that happiness is to be found in meditation practice. Because of that, the mind inclines towards more meditation practice and towards kindness or whatever. Because the mind inclines towards that, you're lifting up the consciousness. Consciousness gets established on a different level. You can feel it right here in this life, but it also affects future lives as well. And one of the things here, which is fascinating about this, is how powerful these things actually are, and how much they actually do affect you. And again, it hasn't just got to do with this life, but it goes across lives as well. So the habits that you form in this life, in terms of sankharas, in terms of volition, you will carry those habits with you into the future. Right, and this is actually very scary, because this is one of the things that you take with you into the future, are these habits we create. This is another reason for being very careful about doing the right thing in this life, because you're bringing that with you into the future. And this is the story, I would mention the story before in the last session, that had an old impact on me when I first heard it. And because it made it very clear how our past life conditioning makes itself felt also in the present life. And this story is a little bit, maybe slightly sidetracked from the main point of the discussion, but it all ties in quite nicely in the end. And this story is a story of a man, he's now actually one of the committee members of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia in Perth. And he decided that he wanted to do a past life regression. I'm not sure exactly why he wanted to do that, probably because he had a friend who did these things, so he decided, I'm going to try it out. And we have another member of the Buddhist Society of Dongyue. He is a past life regressionist, so he does these things on a regular basis. And for those of you who know about this, you will know that actually it is often very unreliable, right? You do this past life regressions, people remember all kind of weird stuff that's got nothing to do with reality, and it's got nothing to do with your past life, it has to do with all kind of other stuff. Or maybe it has to do with that, but you don't really know. There's no way of actually checking whether it does or not. Anyway, he decided that, you know, maybe he would have some interesting experiences by doing this past life regression. So he goes to this past life regressionist and says, okay, let's try it out. And so they try it out. And lo and behold, he has all these memories, right? And in great detail, things like name, things like, you know, who he was married to, the name of his wife, the number of kids he had, what kind of house he lived in. He can remember the shape of the house. He can remember being a poor immigrant coming from Ireland, right? Coming to Australia, building up this farm, working really, really hard to build up the farm, you know, somewhere in the southwest of WA. And remembering all these details. And and of course, the more details you have, the more easy it is to go to the books that, you know, whatever books that kind of record these things, you know, who the immigrants were, the names, and what they did, and all these kind of things. So, first of all, he was kind of shocked, right? What is this stuff I'm remembering? It doesn't make, you know, I don't really feel any relationship to all this stuff. It's kind of weird. And then he realized that, well, he was a Catholic. Well, he was brought up as a Catholic. And even though he was, you know, doing Buddhist meditation, all these kind of things, obviously, he was still heavily influenced and conditioned by his Catholic background. So for him, it was, you know, I don't really want to know about past lives. I don't believe in past lives, right? So he didn't know what to do. And then he decided, well, I've got to find out about this. I've got to find out whether there's some truth to this, or whether it just is a fantasy. Is it just my own madness, or is there some truth to this? So he then goes to these records that exist about people who arrived from Ireland, arrived from overseas, and tries to find out whether such a person existed and had such and such a name and had all the other details. And of course, he finds that specific person seems to exist, right? One detail after the other kind of checks out, right? Checks out. And after a while, of course, Not all the details check out, and that never actually happens to happen. There are a few things that are weird, but 95% of the details just check out. And for him, it was like this revelation. It was like, wow, what is going on here? How is it possible? And for him, it was impossible that this was a coincidence. I don't know, it's very hard to know, is it a coincidence or not, right? You'd have to do some kind of statistical analysis with a number of facts, and check it. Very, very hard to know scientifically. But for him, it was such a powerful experience that he thought, this must be my past life. So he went through this kind of personality crisis, right? And over the next 2 or 3 months was kind of, whoa, you know, well, how am I going to deal with this? There must be a past life, but I don't believe in past life. So what then? And then gradually he came around to, well, actually, you know, if I don't believe it, it must be just a stupid belief. So I'm going to throw that out. And he, afterwards, he was convinced that there'd be such a thing as past lives. So that was the first thing. He went from being a skeptic to being somebody who had confidence in it, which is interesting. It happens to all kind of people. Some people, it's the other way around. You think there is past life, and you become a skeptic, and you know all of these things happen. And that in itself is interesting, right? Why is it that we kind of move around in this belief world so much? Why is it that we can believe in one thing, and we can believe in the diametrical opposite a few years later? Why is that? Is it because we were right before and wrong afterwards? Is it because we were wrong before and right afterwards? Or what is it? And of course, the truth is that we are all conditioned. So our views of the world are just heavily conditioned. And sometimes we don't know that. It feels like I know the truth, right? Rebirth is definitely wrong, right? I know that. It's kind of scientific or whatever. But really, it is a conditioned belief. and if with the right kind of conditioning, he will change. It happens to everybody. It happens all the time. I see this happening all the time. So unless it is your own personal experience, it is very fraught, very uncertain, and liable to change. This in itself is quite fascinating, how we cling on to these views, not really understanding how conditioned they all are. So it's very interesting to see how somebody changes so dramatically. And then but the interesting part of this story, this is just kind of the background, the interesting part of this story is that in this life, this man is a very successful businessman. He started his own business, right? And he's selling some kind of, I think it's software or something like that, I'm not sure exactly what it is. Something anyway to the mining industry. This is WA, everything is about the mining industry. So he's selling something to the mining industry. And he was getting very successful, working very hard, feeling very proud of his work, right? I've started this from scratch through my own free will, right? I'm doing this. I want to do this. And because I want to do it, and because I kind of, it drives me forward and I'm successful, it feels so good, right? You feel I'm doing something worthwhile in life. But then, and this is what is so powerful about this. Then he has his past life experience, and he realizes that his personality in the past life is very much like his personality in the present life. In the past life, he was this poor immigrant coming from Ireland, was working really, really hard, feeling really proud of building up something with from two empty hands, building up this large farm in the southwest of Western Australia. And then when he remembered his deathbed, which was part of the memories, he remembered feeling very proud of this, right? Feeling, wow, I've done something worthwhile, I've really, you know, really worked really hard. But then he realized that actually, that personality trait that he had in the past life, this idea of working really hard, was the same personality trait in his life. He felt, he was absolutely sure that I have been working so hard, building up this business, out of my own free will, because this is fun, right? You're building up a business, you're doing this, this is coming from me. But for the first time he realized it wasn't coming from him at all. It was coming from a personal trait that he had carried with him from the past life. He was running on a program. He was being a robot. The program was written sometime in the distant past. No idea when it had been written. And he was continuing to run on that program in this life. And he said when he saw that, that actually he wasn't in charge at all. It was the program that was in charge. It led to this sense of repulsion. He was got this incredible sense of aversion. I don't want to do this anymore. This is terrible. I felt that I was doing what I wanted to do. I'm not doing what I want to do. I'm just running on this kind of habits from the past. This is the power of this, right? So, and I thought, wow, this is so interesting. So remember that, whatever you do in this life, whenever you feel that you're just carrying out what feels natural, what feels right, what you should be doing, chances are, most of the time, you're just running on this program that was written sometimes in the distant past. You're like a robot, you're like a machine, right? Do you want to be a machine? Or does that make you feel slightly, oh, don't really want to be a machine? When I feel like, you know, somebody's telling me I'm a machine, I want to rebel against that. I want to say, I don't want to be a machine. And so what you do then, when you see that, is that, you know, the things of this life, they start to grab you much less. They become much less important. And you want to free yourself from being this robot. And you want to kind of find some other meaning in life instead. And this is one of the things that we do in meditation practice, the spiritual path, is actually changing our habits and getting a new direction in life so we don't have to keep on running on the same program also in the future or even in this life. We're just changing the program a little bit, right? We're getting a program which actually makes you more happy, which actually leads somewhere rather than just running down the same lane again and again and again. And again, and again, and again, and keeping on doing that until who knows when. So this is one way of understanding this whole thing about volition, the will, and sankharas, and how they are conditioned by ignorance. When the ignorance is the same, when the avijja is the same, the volitions will be the same, and they will just carry on into the future in exactly the same way, life after life, right? Again and again and again, until one day you you have past life regression, right? And it's like, whoa, don't want to do this anymore. Or even better, remembering the past life is much more powerful. Then you see this in a very, very powerful sense, and you just want to get rid of the whole thing. Yeah. Okay, so this is then, this is how avijja leads to sankharas, and the different levels of avijja will lead to different levels of sankhara, different levels of delusion lead to different levels of activity, different levels of volition. And your volition kind of gets established in a new place. And when the volition gets established in a new place, again, because you have to take ownership of that will, you have to take ownership of the choices you make in life, it affects the level of your mind. Your consciousness gets into different levels, right? Your consciousness, which feels generally more happy, which has is brighter, which is kind of more, you know, is more wholesome, or the consciousness that is more dark, or somewhere in between. So this is how we then raise our mind. And as I said, you can feel that in this very life. But of course, an interesting point is what happens when you die. And this is where we come to the link between sankhara and vijnana, which is the next linkage here. So you have the linkage from all your activities and that you do to the level of consciousness. So you can see how the level of consciousness is affected in this very life itself. If you live a good life, gradually your level of consciousness would shift, and you're kind of on this trajectory going up, right? And you can feel that there's something happening, good, something good inside of you is happening, just lifting up of consciousness itself. You can see it happening in this life. And in this way, we are establishing the mind at a new level. And this has a specific word in the Pali language. It's called the vijnana titti. And titti means establishment or standing. So the consciousness is established at different levels, basically. And the book talks about, you know, certain important levels. There's obviously an endless number of levels. It's just that you can kind of fine-tune it down to almost, you know, as much as you want. But there are kind of certain stages that are more important than others. It doesn't matter for the purpose of this what those stages are. But essentially, you're establishing your mind, your consciousness. And then, when you pass away, because your mind, your consciousness, is already established at a particular level in this life, and remember, it is established by the force of the sankharas, the force of the volition. When you die, your consciousness is already at that particular level, right? So you tend to continue in that direction as a consequence. So your consciousness is already there. So the conscious level in this life would directly relate to the consciousness level upon when you get reborn in a future life. This is how this works. And not only your consciousness, but as I said, also your volitions, also the way that you, the things that you are interested in life, where your consciousness is intending to, will also have shifted, right? So consciousness and intention often go very closely together. So now, because if you meditate really well, you get reborn in this meditative realm, right? The jhana realm or something like that. And then that's where your interest is, right? That's where the reason why you stay there is because your volition is pointing towards that. That's where the volition wants to be. That's why it works like this. You can see this when you live in a community like a monastery, or you can see this anywhere really. You can see that you can see roughly where people are at by what they're talking about. And people who are really interested in meditation, they're talking about meditation practice. Where is their happiness? So you can kind of get some feeling for people's, you know, state of mind by what they are interested in. And the reason they're interested in that is because their volition is pointing in that direction. That's where you're inclining to. So you talk about those things. If you get an immaterial attainment, very, very high meditation attainment, that's what you're talking about. That's what you're interested in. Because your volition is pointing in that direction. So we are driven by these things. And that also is what you take with you into a future existence. So that is how that comes about. And of course, the interesting point here is maybe finish that off just very briefly, just saying what happens. Your consciousness gets established in that new existence. And when you do that, The two next factors on this interdependent horizon is called nama rupa in the Pali language, sometimes translated as name and form. Okay, I don't know if that makes any sense to you, name and form, you know. sometimes translated as mentality, materiality, that's a bit more evocative. Mentality, everything to do with the mind. Materiality, everything to do with the physical world, right? But basically what it means is that everything, it means all your experiences, right? You have consciousness on the one hand, which is awareness. And then on the other hand, you have all your experiences. So when the consciousness gets established, you get reborn at this particular level, whatever level that might be, your experiences will correspond to that level. So your experiences have certain limits, right? If you are reborn as a human being, you have certain experiences. There are certain limits on your experiences. You don't experience the happiness of a devadoka. You don't experience what it's like to be an animal. You have experiences that correspond to the human world. There are certain limits. Of course, there are variations within the human world, but there are certain limits. And wherever you are reborn, the limits of the experience you can have are set by the station of your consciousness. This is how nama rupa then comes after consciousness. It just basically means experience as such. I'll talk more about this later on, because this is a very important point. This whole thing about consciousness and nama rupa and how it interacts is very, very important. But not for now, because it's getting a little bit too late for now. But what I want to do instead, I just want to have a very brief look at what happens at the very beginning of this path. Again, right? When avidya disappears, when delusion disappears, what happens then? Because this is what we're trying to do. The hindrances are taken away, right? When the hindrances disappear, the mind becomes very powerful, very bright. There are no distortions in the mind anymore, because the hindrances are what distort the mind. And then you have the ability for the first time to see things clearly. And if you keep on doing this, if you keep on getting deep meditations, you keep on getting rid of the distortions, that in the end, what happens is that you will eventually see things according to reality. Then when you see things according to reality, you will understand that all of these things, right? I was saying before, the five khandhas, the five groups of existence, the five groups of personality, they are suffering according to the Buddha's teaching. Very hard to understand, but that's what he says. So when you see that, when you see that these five groups of existence are suffering, you can no longer intend towards those things. You can no longer be interested in those things. All of those things, you lose interest in that. And because of that, your volition, your will, your drive, which always kind of is pushing you forward into some kind of desired future, there is no desired future anymore. So you're no longer projecting yourself into the future, because you realize that everything you ever desired actually is not worth desiring. There's something else called the ending of all this stuff, which is far, far better than anything you can have. So because of that, your volition stops. You don't create anymore, because there's nothing to be created. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to be had. And this is where this thing becomes very profound, right? And because you're not creating anything more, because there's no craving that projects you into the future, because there's nothing to crave for, it means you become peaceful inside. And consciousness is no longer established anywhere. This is one of the things, if you read the suttas, you may have seen there's something sometimes called unestablished consciousness, which is not a very good word really, but it kind of gets to the point. Consciousness is not established anywhere, because consciousness is no longer driven by the sankharas, which are either good or bad, right? And because of that, there is no establishment of consciousness in any of these realms. So when you die, because consciousness isn't established in this life, there is nowhere that it can be established also in the future. And this is how this whole thing called samsara comes to an end, right? It comes to an end. Finished. So this is how that works, and it's hard to imagine. How can it be that you have no desire for anything anymore, that whole of existence kind of becomes irrelevant? It's very hard to understand that, and the reason is hard to understand because it must come from inside, from understanding of these things. Now the first one of the first insight, which is very helpful on this path, is when you become a stream enter. This is what kind of the basic insight for understanding the Dhamma. It's basic in the sense that it gives you the full understanding of Buddhism. It's not basic in the sense that it's, you know, it's easy, you just sit back and you become a stream enter. Basic in that sense. But it's basic in the sense that it gives you a full understanding of what's going on. And one of the things that happens when you become a stream enter is that you see for the first time that you are not the doer, right? It is not actually you. You are not responsible for all of these things. The doing is that comes from conditions. Why do you do anything? Why do you will anything? Why do you have a volition? Why are you inclining in a certain direction? And it all comes from conditions in the past. Just like this man who had this past life regression, he was suddenly seeing that he was just this robot. And that's what you're seeing. You're seeing that all of your volitions are constructed through conditioning, right? Your past life, in this life, you can see how you are. In this life, it's very easy to see how you are the son, the product of who your parents were, where you went to school, all of these things. But much more deeply, also part and parcel of that is the conditioning from the past lives as well. And when you see that, one of the wonderful things about that, of course, is that you are no longer responsible, right? Not responsible anymore. And of course, if you're not responsible, it means that you can't judge yourself. And when you can't judge, this is why the stream entry, it says in the sutta, it says that the stream entry can never be reborn in a bad destination. Because the stream entry, he or she, is incapable of judging themselves. Because they know that ultimately they're not in charge. It's the conditioning that is in charge. And this is why this is so liberating. People might wonder, why is this kind of, this is one reason why it's so liberating. Because then you, whenever, if you do happen to do something which is a little bit wrong, it is not that the stream enter doesn't usually do very many bad things, but if you do something that's a little bit wrong, you can let it go straight away, because you realize it's just causes and conditions playing themselves out, and really you're not really ultimately responsible at all. So we should try in our life, again, remember that dependent arising here is a practical thing, right? It's not something which is meant purely for theoretical reasons. So one of the ways of approaching this is to contemplate non-self in our own lives, to understand the extent to which we are conditioned. And if you start to reflect on that, and to start to think about your character, who you are, how you act, and how often, how difficult it is to control yourself, right? Sometimes it's almost as anger just happens, or sometimes desire happens, and you can't really stop it. And in a very deep sense, it is true, you probably can't stop it. It feels like you can't stop it, but actually, you probably can't. And the more clarity you get about that, the more you reflect on that, the more you see that that is true, you're approaching the same insight that the stream enter has, and it makes it easy for yourself to forgive yourself. So remember that, this is what contemplating non-self is about. It helps you to let go, it helps you to forgive, it helps you, you know, it's so easy to be critical of people around us, right? They shouldn't have done that, they are responsible. But they are just like us, there's no self there, they're not really responsible. They are caught up in conditioning, and it's so easy to forgive somebody else, even your worst enemy, right? Even people you feel are destroying the world, they are terrorists, they are destroying the climate or whatever it is. You can forgive because you realize they too are just a function of conditioning in the past. They don't really know what they're doing. It's not as if they want to be evil, but I'm going to be really evil and destroy the world. That's not what it is about at all. They actually think they're doing the right thing. And this is the problem. And that's why it is so hard to convince them otherwise sometimes. So very powerful reflection, and it kind of helps you, and it makes you understand how forgiveness, how letting go, how all of these things happen. If you can forgive others, you can forgive yourself. If you can forgive yourself, you can forgive others. These things go together. Lack of judgment goes in both, you know, both, always goes together like that. And then life becomes much easier as a consequence. So that is just a little bit about how to use this. I'm always concerned about getting too theoretical, but actually it's not theoretical at all. Because the main point of what I've been talking about is the sense that your volition, whatever drives you, whatever you do in life, affects you in a very fundamental, important way. Try to feel that. Try to feel that every act you do, every time you feel that you are doing something, see how it actually affects your level of consciousness. And then you start to get this sense of urgency, right? We talk about in Buddhism, sense of urgency. You can't really afford to do anything wrong anymore because you can see how it drags you down every time. And every time you do something good, it lifts you up. So it means you start to take every opportunity in life, every chance you have to do what is good, to say what is good, to think what is good, right? About other people, and avoiding the bad things, because you understand the incredibly powerful effect this has on your very existence right here and now, and also about the future and future lives as well.